When I was a young child, I remember an evangelist came to our church, my home church, and he was teaching on Revelation 21. When he was talking about the structure of this cube that's described in Revelation 21, 9 to 21, he presented all of us a sheet of paper with a graphic, a picture of this cube, and he said to us, this is what the new heavens and new earth are going to look like. So here I am as a young boy, I'm holding this picture, and you know, I've been told that when we die, we're going to go to heaven, and Jesus is going to come back and make all things new. And I'm looking at this piece of paper, and seeing this cube seemed really disappointing. It seemed disappointing because that's it? We're going to live in a gigantic cube. The length is the same way as the width. It's the same way as the height. Now, the guy who was preaching, he assured us that the cubic feet of this cube is going to be so large that it will encompass billions of believers. So we could all live there, he says, without a problem. But that our hope should be a cube. Now, I think he was absolutely wrong in what he was presenting. And not only do I think he was wrong, I think his referent was wrong because he was thinking this is about the new heavens and new earth, and what God's creating is this glorious large cube for all of us to live in. I'm going to suggest to you that the cube picture is a metaphor for the church, the people of God, the bride of the Lamb, which is what Revelation 21:9 opens with. And that we will live in a new heavens and new earth. And Revelation 21 begins with talking about a new heaven and new earth. But beginning in verse 9, the New Jerusalem is used with an emphasis on the people, not the place. The idea of a city in Revelation does have people and place connected to it. And the writer can at any one point emphasize one aspect of that city imagery more so than another aspect. Important to remember is that Babylon the Great is the city that receives the judgment. And not only is this object of God's judgment described as a city, Babylon the Great, given that title, with terrible Old Testament background and imagery that helps us see how warranted the wrath of God is upon that place. But you also have this image of an unfaithful harlot that's riding upon the beast in Revelation 17. So that when God's judgment comes, it's not just against a place, a location, a latitude and longitude. It is against a people. And when God's judgment comes, it's not only against a people, but an actual place. I think the Babylon the Great and unfaithful harlot imagery, this is the single object of God's judgment throughout most of Revelation here, provides an important parallel to what I think is going on with a contrast. And the parallel is, here you have this new Jerusalem that's been described in Revelation 21:1. Verses 1 and 2. And beginning in verses 9 and 10, you have this description of the bride, the wife of the Lamb, and then in verse 10, a holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. Most readers of these verses, I think, and I used to fit that category as well, are going to read the description about the gates and the wall and the foundations and the street of gold and the glass and the jewels and the pearls and all of that as a description of the new heavens and new earth. This is what the new Jerusalem place is going to look like. But I don't think the writer is emphasizing the New Jerusalem aspect of place here. I think he is emphasizing primarily people. Primarily people. Because of how verse 9 begins. Now, in order to investigate the details properly, I think we need to have an overview of what John has been doing with regard to Ezekiel's book. And by overview, I don't mean detailed overview. I mean the general outline of Ezekiel's book, I think it can be argued, has served as an outline generally for the book of Revelation. Let me give you some examples. In Ezekiel 1, there's this great description of glory and majesty that is seen from God. In Ezekiel 2, there's a scroll written on both sides. And in Ezekiel 3, John, or the prophet Ezekiel, eats the scroll. In Ezekiel 16 and chapter 23 as well, there's a harlot, an unfaithful prostitute that Jerusalem is compared with. Between the eating of the scroll and the description of the harlot Jerusalem, judgment after judgment after judgment against Jerusalem is described with various prophetic acts and predictions. In Ezekiel 26, 27, and 28, the luxury of nations, Tyre in particular, is described. In Ezekiel 29 and chapter 32, there is a supper where the flesh of enemies are eaten. In Ezekiel 29 and chapter 32, a dragon is overcome and led under God's sovereign power. In Ezekiel 37, there's a resurrection of the dead. Israelites are like the bones in a valley that Ezekiel prophesies over with breath, and the valley of dry bones gives birth to this army from the dead. Now, in Ezekiel 37, this isn't a bodily resurrection first and foremost. It's what God says will be the restoration of the exiles to the land under Cyrus. Then in Ezekiel 38 and 39, Gog and Magog are mentioned. In the last nine chapters of the book, Ezekiel 40 to 48, is this depiction of new temple and new creation. Cosmic, glorious temple. That outline is one of many sets of and groups of chapters one could point to that correspond with something in Revelation. You could mention more things in Ezekiel than just that. But what's interesting is the order of those events in Ezekiel, and I've listed quite a bit of them, form a general outline also for the book of Revelation. For example, in Revelation 1 and in Revelation 4, there is glory and majesty that is beheld by John. In Revelation 5, he sees a scroll that's written on both sides. In Revelation 10, he eats this scroll. And throughout these chapters of Revelation, there's chapter after chapter that I've suggested to you gives us judgments against first century Jerusalem that would have been fulfilled in 70 AD. In Revelation 17, there's this harlot, an unfaithful prostitute, that is also considered a city, Babylon the Great. This is an unfaithful and judgment-deserving people. In Revelation 18, the luxury of Babylon the Great is depicted with a background of Ezekiel 26, 27, and 28. In Revelation 19, there's a supper, and, well, two suppers, really, the marriage supper of the Lamb, but the enemies of God at the end of Revelation 19 are consumed by birds. That image of supper is there, also from Ezekiel. Then in Revelation 20, there is a dragon that's overcome. In Revelation 20, there's a resurrection. In Revelation 20, there's Gog and Magog. And in Revelation 21 and 22, a new temple, new creation, this cosmic, glorious new heaven reality that's promised. Why does that outline matter? Well, first of all, the many correspondences, I think, confirm that John is very interested in the subjects and the order and outline of the book of Ezekiel. But the reason Revelation 21 is an appropriate place to meditate on the outline of Ezekiel is because what John ends with, he's depicting the fulfillment of what Ezekiel ends with. Now, Ezekiel's prophecy ends with this great, large temple that's going to be constructed. Massive, massive. And it provides imagery, both directly and through allusion, to John's book in Revelation 21, 9 and following. So here's how we can break down Revelation 21, verses 9 to 21. Verses 9, 10, and 11 introduces for us the metaphor of the city. The metaphor of the city. He starts talking about a bride, and then talks about seeing a city coming down from heaven that has the glory of God. Verses 12 to 14 describe for us the wall and the gates of the city. Verses 15 to 17 give us the shape and the measurements of the city. And in verse 4, the materials in the city. What's everything made out of? What's the street made out of? And the city is at large. What are what's on the walls and the foundations? What are all these things made of? So the materials in the city, verses 18 to 21. In verse 9, we see a connection to a previous chapter in Revelation because of the angel who's coming to give something to John, this revelation of this bride in this city. Notice how the speaker is described. He's not just any angel, but one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues. That language is almost identical to chapter 17:1. Listen to chapter 17:1. One of the seven angels who had seven bowls came and said, and then what he says in chapter 17:1 is, come, I'll show you the judgment of the great prostitute. Look at our chapter tonight in chapter 21:9. Come, I will show you the bride. I think the language in chapter 21:9 is a clear allusion back to chapter 17:1. We are meant to connect this angel that invited John first earlier to see the judgment upon the unfaithful harlot. And now he's inviting John to behold the bride, the wife of the Lamb. So that those two female figures are in direct contrast to each other in the book of Revelation. The unfaithful harlot deserves God's judgment, and the faithful, glorious bride or wife of the Lamb will be forever with God and God with his people. So in verse 9, we're meant to be thinking of this earlier angel, and we're meant to be thinking of the earlier judgment on that unholy harlot. Also important to note is the judgment upon the harlot is the judgment at the same time on Babylon the Great, because the harlot is Babylon the Great, not only a people but a city. Which means not only are we being invited in chapter 21:9 and 10 to see the glorious bride that's faithful, we see not only a contrast of the women, but a contrast of the cities. A contrast of the cities. The bride who's faithful is the contrast to the unfaithful harlot. And the new Jerusalem is the contrast to the unfaithful old Jerusalem, whose judgment is predicted and depicted in the bowls and previous to that trumpets and previous to that seals of judgment. So I think the holy city and bride of Yahweh should be understood in light of the Old Testament background of faithless Jerusalem that was judged again and again by God. And now in chapter 21, we are reminded of what the writer had mentioned earlier about an angel depicting the judgment that was coming on that city again. We're now seeing the contrast in chapter 21:9. Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Notice it's not the bride of Christ. It doesn't mean it's not Christ who's meant, because of course the Lamb is Christ. But this is the only time Lamb is mentioned. We see it first mentioned in chapter 5, verse 6. Between the throne and the four living creatures and among the elders, I saw a Lamb standing as though it had been slain. It's referring to the crucified Christ who is now risen and reigning on high. Now in chapter 21:9, the wife of the Lamb is the wife of the Savior, the Redeemer. This Lamb has bought the bride, redeemed the bride, atoned for the sins of his people. John is being invited to behold the bride because Christ has come. This is the return that we have seen earlier at the end of chapter 20 with resurrection from the dead and final judgment, which the Gospels and Paul's letters tell us involves the return of Christ. Well, after the return of Christ, after the casting of unbelievers into the lake of fire, what will the people of God be? The people of God will be united with the bridegroom who is Christ. For they are the bride, the wife of the Lamb. In chapter 21, verse 9. We're already introduced to bridal language earlier in chapter 19. In verse 7, we're told, let us rejoice and exult and give him glory. For the marriage of the Lamb has come. The bride has made herself ready. Can you imagine that anticipation? They know the day of ultimate wedding and consummation is coming. And God's promises will come to pass, every one. And so the bride is ready, the bride is ready, and then the return of Christ happens, dead or raised. The judgment on the unbelievers and the vindication of the saints is accomplished. A new heavens and new earth, and now the bride of Christ will dwell in the dwelling place with the bridegroom forever. The old Jerusalem is judged. The harlot has been put down. And now a new Jerusalem, a bride, is seen in glory. In verse 10, we see where the following vision is going to take place. John tells us that he's carried away in the Spirit. In the Spirit. It's not the first time that language is used. Chapter 1, verse 10. chapter 4, verse 1, and chapter 17, verse 3. That language of being carried away in the Spirit is thought by some to comprise the basic divisions of the book. So that chapter 1, verse 10 is connected to the opening vision of Christ, which takes us through the seven letters to the churches and chapters 2 and 3. Chapter 4, 1, being caught up in the Spirit, is given again, and it takes us all the way through the throne scenes and the seals and the trumpets and the bowls to the end of chapter 16. Then in chapter 17, verse 3, the imagery of the harlot and the beast is given, and then the judgment of the harlot in chapter 18, and the rejoicing in chapter 19, and then the defeat of the false prophet and beast and Satan and unbelievers all in chapter 20. And here in chapter 21, verse 10, caught up in the Spirit again. Caught up in the Spirit again. Doesn't mean, though, that he's physically removed. I've suggested in each of these places, chapter 1, verse 10, chapter 4, verse 1, chapter 17, 3, and here in chapter 21, 10, that he has not left the island of Patmos when he has these visions. It's like the Old Testament experiences of the prophets. They didn't leave the earth when they went to go and see a vision somewhere. They were spiritually perceiving these things by God's power. And John's latitude and longitude never changed on Patmos, I don't believe. He was there the whole time, and yet at the same time is carried away in the Spirit to a great high mountain. It's interesting that the high mountain is the location given here. Earlier, the unfaithful harlot is in the wilderness. You see that in chapter 17:3. But this isn't a scene in the wilderness when he's beholding the bride. He's on a high mountain. Mountains are very important in the Old Testament. Think of Mount Sinai, where Moses is given 10 commandments. Or Mount Nebo in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses is shown the promised land. But not only those passages, Ezekiel chapter 40 could be what's in view. And remember, I said earlier, Ezekiel 40 to 48. Is a major section of Ezekiel's prophecy that John is interested in these latter chapters of the book. Ezekiel 40, verse 2, in the visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel and set me down on a very high mountain. On a very high mountain. And there, on that high mountain, Ezekiel is going to see things that John alludes to, who himself has taken to a very high mountain. I think more than the experience of Moses, the experience of Ezekiel is in view. What is John shown? This matters because it gives us an interpretive key to the following measurements and materials described. In verse 10, it tells us, he showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. Verses 9 and 10 must be held together because John's told, I will show you the bride in verse 10. And then in verse 10, when he goes and sees something coming down, you would expect the bride. You'd expect to see the white dress and the veil. You'd expect to see her coming down the aisle, if you will. But what do you see after he's told, I'll show you the bride? In verse 10, he sees a holy city coming down. I don't think the subjects have switched, though. I think that what's happened is the same thing you see in chapter 5 when John hears about the lion of the tribe of Judah and then turns and sees not a lion but a lamb. And I think it's the same thing that happens in chapter 7 verses 1 to 8 and then the rest of that chapter. John hears about 144,000 from every tribe and then he sees a multitude from every nation. I think the hearing and then seeing episodes combine the scenes to show that they are mutually interpretive. And by that I mean we should understand the bride, the wife of the Lamb, to be what John has shown so that the metaphor helps us interpret what the bride is depicted to be. The bride is depicted to be this holy dwelling place. This holy dwelling place. More on that in a moment. In verse 10, the new Jerusalem is coming down out of heaven. Now, it's not called the new one here. It's called the holy city Jerusalem. But earlier in verse 2, I think we get the picture. I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven. The Old Testament held out hope that there would be a New Jerusalem. And not only that, a New Jerusalem on a mountain. A final resting place where the city would be a mountain that would fill the earth. Isaiah 2, Micah 4. It's this picture that when God is going to bring things to their close and was going to bring an end to evil and death and bring to pass his peace and reconciliation and glory in the world, not only would Jerusalem be matter, but so would a mountain. I think John is showing here the fulfillment of those Old Testament hopes and expectations. God has not changed his mind. We just see that transposed on a higher key, it has to do with the new creation and the people of God in particular after the return of Christ. People of God have been raised from the dead and they are going to dwell with Christ, who is their bridegroom, forever in the new creation. In a way, they are the new Jerusalem. They're a dwelling place for God. Now in verse 11, we get a sense of dwelling place because it tells us this city has the glory of God. The glory of God. In the Old Testament, the book of Exodus shows us that the glory of God fills the tabernacle. In 1 Kings, the glory of God fills the temple. In Isaiah 6, the glory of God even fills the earth. Because the place where God dwells is a place where his glory is. Which means that this city coming down out of heaven, having the glory of God, it tells us that this city is a dwelling place. Its radiance is like a most rare jewel, like a jasper. This also indicates the presence of God because jasper appears in Revelation 4:3 when God is on his throne. And remember in Revelation 4, various colors and beautiful things are seen as the glory of God is reflecting and shining. Here in Revelation 21:11, the glory of God has a radiance like a most rare jewel, like jasper. This is about the presence of God. The direct presence of God in its glory and weight and majesty. The temple is a place where God's glory and presence dwells, which means that whatever's coming down, this bride, this wife, this city, it has to do with God indwelling. And that, friends, is weighty and glorious. In verse 12, we see in verses 12 to 14, the wall and the gates of the city. So let's think about this metaphor. John's going to give us a lot of description here. First, it's a great high wall. This great high wall is important for the ancient world because you had to protect your city. You never knew what was going to happen to your city, and it offered security. The security, if your wall was torn down, it could be bad things for your city. Think of Jericho for a moment. Jericho was vulnerable in the book of Joshua, because the wall fell down by the power of God. In 586 BC, Nebuchadnezzar not only destroyed Jerusalem, but the walls of the city. So that when the people returned to the land under King Cyrus in 538 BC, they began to rebuild the temple. But later on, under Nehemiah's ministry, he had to rebuild the walls. And in 444 BC, the walls were rebuilt in 52 days. Because the walls matter. They're a barrier. They're a division. They say who's in the city and who's not in the city. Those walls help distinguish who's in and who's out. This wall suggests to us that this city is secure. This city is impenetrable because it's a great high wall. And this is a high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels. You see the number 12 over and over again. Three times in this verse alone. 12 gates, 12 angels, the names of the 12 tribes. And I think that last use of 12 there, the 12 tribes, helps us see why the number 12 is so important. The number 12 is important because the people of God in the Old Testament were comprised of 12 tribes who were Jacob's sons. And these 12 gates and angels at these gates seem to symbolize the tribes of Israel. I don't think we should overread this literally. I think the 12 is significant and symbolizes the tribes of Israel. The names are on the gates and the angels. Now, an angel at an entrance, especially in association with a high wall that means security, to keep people in and to keep people out, these angels at gates might remind us of the Garden of Eden, where there was an eastern entrance where a cherubim stood with a flaming sword to prevent Adam and Eve from re-entering the garden and availing themselves of the tree of life. Now, in verse 12, 12 gates and 12 angels, I think, suggest to us this is not simply a return to Eden, but something far greater than that. And yet, at the same time, it makes us think of this garden, a place where God dwelled in Genesis 2 and 3 with Adam and Eve. So people and place have been connected with the dwelling place of God from the beginning in Genesis 2 and 3. Isaiah 6 envisions that when God created the world in Genesis 1, it was a grand cosmic dwelling place and temple, so that throughout this world, God is there. He is omnipresent. But then there are these special and specific manifestations of his glory and presence in the tabernacle and the temple and in Christ. For Jesus is tabernacling with us, the word that became flesh in John 1:14. Jesus is God with us. Where he is, there is God, because the Son is eternally divine, not just 100% man. But it also reminds us that Jesus can speak of himself and his body in temple language. Remember John 2, where Jesus said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it back up." Because the tabernacle was absorbed by the temple, and the temple absorbed by Christ. And by absorbed, I mean the purpose of it and the trajectory of it was fulfilled in God's progressive plan of redemption. And so not only is Jesus the temple of God, but we find that the church, being the body of the head who is Christ, the church of Jesus Christ is a temple. His Spirit dwells within us. And I think when Ezekiel is casting forth this great vision in Ezekiel 40 to 48, it's fulfilled in the new creation with the church of Jesus Christ. And that's what John is describing here, coming down from heaven, having the glory of God, the presence of God. And like jasper, clear as crystal. This is the glory and presence of God residing in this latter day Jerusalem. But this isn't a Jerusalem like the actual city. This is grander. This far surpasses that previous shadow. It's eclipsed, that previous shadow is, by the church of Jesus Christ and new creation. So in verse 12, these gates and angels and 12 tribes are all centering around the number 12. We'll see that this number 12 is used again and again as some sort of base. And we'll see how that can connect to the people of God. One other reference, though, for you. The 12 gates that are mentioned here, they echo Ezekiel 48. Ezekiel 48. Because in Ezekiel's new temple, the new temple was going to have 12 gates. And a single tribe was written on each gate in the book of Ezekiel. So the fact that there are 12 gates here and the names of tribes on these gates, to me, unmistakably links it to what Ezekiel was envisioning, and John is announcing the fulfillment of it. Look at the arrangement of the gates in verse 13. On the east there are three, on the north there are three, on the south there are three, on the west there are three. The compass directions here might remind us of the encampments in Numbers, where three tribes were north of the tabernacle, three were to the east, three were to the south, three were to the west. And it's as if each of these gates is representing a tribe. I think that's what verses 11, 12, and 13 are suggesting. But, or verse 12 and 13, rather, that's what they're suggesting. And it has this Old Testament background, because where the tabernacle went, there the presence of God was, right? Because God was indwelling the most holy place. He was amidst the people. This is affirming for us and confirming for us that this is about the people of God with the presence of God because of this Old Testament background. Then in verse 14, we get the last part about the walls and the gates. The wall had 12 foundations. So there you have the number 12 again. And on them were the 12 names, so there's 12, of the who? 12 apostles of the Lamb. You had a reference to the 12 tribes in verse 12, and now a reference to the 12 apostles here in verse 14. And not just of anyone, but of the Lamb. Once again, a reference to the crucified and risen, reigning Jesus. The 12 apostles are a foundation of the temple here, and they are a foundation of the church in Ephesians 2:20. They help comprise it. Foundations were large stones that were beautiful and strong, especially if they were used for temple construction, like in 1 Kings 5 with the temple in Jerusalem under the reign of Solomon. Now, if you add 12 and 12 together, 12 tribes and 12 apostles, you get the number 24, and that's sometimes where people suggest the 24 elders come from in Revelation 4, that they're representative of the people of God, because 12 and 12 together make 24. Now, it could also be alternatively that there were temple servants divided into 24 orders of priests. It's 1 Chronicles 24. There were 24 Levitical gatekeepers. That's 1 Chronicles 26. And there were 24 orders of Levites who prophesied and praised the Lord in 1 Chronicles 25. So there are other ways that people get to explaining the 24 elders in Revelation 4. But one possibility is the combination of 12 tribes and 12 apostles. Especially because in Revelation 4, though the 12 and 12 aren't added together there, you can see how two 12 references are made in Revelation 21 to tribes and apostles. And so those who see that as a base to get to the 24 elders have reason for it here in chapter 21, because the writer gives you two 12s, 12 tribes, 12 apostles. What this could suggest is that in this city, wall and foundations and gates, you've got these uses of 12 tribes, 12 apostles, that this structure is about the people of God. The structure is about the people of God. In 1 Corinthians 3:16 and 17, the people of God are a temple. In 1 Corinthians 6:19, same way. 2 Corinthians 6:16, same truth. Ephesians 2, 20 and 22, same truth. Listen to 1 Peter 2. I've given a few references, but let me actually read this. In 1 Peter 2, listen to how this writer speaks about the people of God. In verse 5 of 1 Peter 2, "You yourselves are like living stones being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ." In verse 9, "You're a chosen race, a holy priesthood, a holy nation, a royal priesthood, holy nation, people for his own possession." See, they're a temple that God is building together. And they're a multiracial church, multi-ethnic church, multilingual church. People from every nation, tribe, and tongue in Revelation are the people of God. And the incorporation of tribes and apostles into the structure of this description here, I think helps us affirm that the people of God are in view, and we need to understand it in light of temple imagery. What Revelation 21, 9 and following is telling us is that the bride of God is the temple of God. The wife of the Lamb is a dwelling place for the Spirit to be. In verses 15 to 17, we get the shapes and the measurements of the city. The shapes and the measurements of the city. And what we see in verse 15 is, "The one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold." This references again, at least by allusion, to Ezekiel 40. Earlier we saw in Ezekiel 40 verse 2, John was taken to a very high mountain like Ezekiel was here. Ezekiel 40 verse 2, Ezekiel is brought to the land of Israel and taken to a very high mountain. But notice what happens next in verse 3. Ezekiel 43 says, "There was a man whose appearance was like bronze with a linen cord and a measuring reed in his hand." So he's going to measure things. And now, in John's day, not only is he taken to a very high mountain, but here in verse 15, the person who was speaking with him now has a measuring rod of gold to measure things. Ezekiel 40 seems to be in view. What Ezekiel is prophesying and depicting for his readers is what John's describing in fulfillment. The new heavens and new earth, with primary emphasis here on the church of Jesus Christ as the city bride or city church of the Lamb. The people of God are also described this way earlier in Revelation in chapter 3, verse 2. "The one who overcomes will be a pillar in the temple of my God. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which descends from heaven from God in my new name." Well, Revelation 3:12 is important for a passage like ours tonight because it shows us that the people of God are associated with the name of the city so that when John sees the New Jerusalem coming down, it doesn't have to be something other than the bride. It's really what Revelation 3:12 describes. The people of God who are pillars in the temple of God. They comprise and are the stones, to use 1 Peter 2:5 again, the stones of God's dwelling place. This person who appears to John then and is speaking takes out this rod of gold to measure the city and its gates. And what he determines is in verse 16, the city is four square. Four square. The question before us is why the city would be four square. In the Old Testament, there was a clear indication in the construction of the tabernacle and the temple that the most holy place was a cube. All the lengths of the most holy place were the same. And also in the new temple, Ezekiel was prophesying in Ezekiel 42:15-20, and in Ezekiel 45:2, what Ezekiel prophesied was laid out four square. This tells me why the measurements matter. The measurements matter of this city because John, in providing these measurements, is identifying this structure as a temple. As a temple where God will dwell. We are watching the most holy place descend. John gives for us the measurement of this city according to the angel. The angel measures the city with his rod 12,000 stadia. The length and the width and the height are equal. Then he measured its wall 144 cubits by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement in verse 17. Again, I think he's using human figures, but he's telling us it's the angel's measurement. The angel is doing the measuring and using human increments to do so. And cubits is what's used for the wall here. And then stadia are given in light of the, for the length and width and height of the city. Now, let's think about the actual translation of this into our increments. If you're going to calculate this physically, you're looking at about 1,400 miles long, 1,400 miles wide, 1,400 miles high. This is pretty grand. And if you look at the wall in verse 17, 144 cubits, that's about 216 feet. No, notice the disparity here. The length and width and height of the city, 1,400 miles. Not 1,400 feet. 1,400 miles. This is going to extend into space, right? If we were to overread this literally, which I've cautioned against. Why the disparity? Because if the city is that high, why would you not want a wall that's comparable to that? The wall is 144 cubits high, which is 216 feet. That's a pretty small wall, 216 feet, in light of an enormously great height of 1,400 miles, approximately. But don't let the disparity unnerve us at all in verses 16 and 17, because we're not meant to take this literally. What's the significance of these numbers? Notice the bases that comprise them. The number 12. In verse 16, the city is 12,000 stadia. 12,000 one way, 12,000 another way, 12,000 another way. It's 12 times 1,000 twelves. That gives us 12,000 stadia. Then, look in verse 17, 144 cubits. How did you get to 144, John? 12 times 12. So 12 squared is 144 cubits. Friends, think of it this way. 12 gates, 12 angels at the gates, 12 tribes. There are 12 foundations that have 12 names of the 12 apostles. The city is four square and its length is 12,000 12,000 one way, and then 12 times 12 when you get to the height of the wall. From verses 9 to 17, we're again and again being given multiple, many, numerous indications that we're dealing with the people of God here. The name of people of God is all over it by the use of the number 12. This is how the New Testament works with this number, because in Matthew's Gospel, well, in all the Gospels, Jesus gathers a new Israel, a true Israel, with 12 disciples. And when Jesus feeds the 5,000, there are 12 basketfuls left over in Matthew. And I think that has to do with Old Testament imagery about people of God. So the number 12 in the New Testament is important for that. And the fact that 12 is used as a base for these measurements and the number of things again and again and again, it seems unmistakable to me and undeniable to me that he considers this symbolic, and that we should understand this structure to be the people of God as a temple. I'm not denying that there aren't foundations or structures or things that can be measured or gates or walls or beauty or jewels in the new creation. What I'm telling you is, I don't think verses 9 through 21 are about John describing the new heavens and new earth. I think he's depicting the people of God that are in the new heavens and new earth. They're like God's glorious temple. After all, in Jerusalem, you had a temple. So in the new Jerusalem, the appropriate question is, well, where's the temple in the new creation? Well, the Church of Jesus Christ is the dwelling place of God. You don't need a physical temple. That's what verse 22 tells us. I saw no temple in the city, but alas, we're getting ahead of ourselves. All right. The last section of the chapter tonight that we will deal with is in verses 18 to 21. The materials in the city. And these are beautiful materials. The wall in verse 18 is made of jasper. So you see the appearance of that word again. And the city was pure gold, clear as glass. What a beautiful depiction here. Pure gold would be especially appropriate in light of 1 Kings, where the temple was overlaid with gold. In other words, if you see a city that's overlaid with gold, and all this other imagery supports a temple referent, then once again, the fact that the city is of pure gold helps us with one additional affirmation now to speak about this structure as a temple. Just like in 1 Kings, Solomon used gold. Now in verse 19, it tells us the foundations of the wall were adorned with jewels. And in verses 19 to 20, you know how many jewels there are? 12. Not 11, not 13, but 12. 12 jewels. And the importance of them is not necessarily what they represent individually. They're jasper, sapphire, agate, emerald, onyx, carnelian, chrysolite, beryl, topaz, chrysoprase, jacinth, and amethyst. But these foundations, which by the way had, according to verse 14, the names of the 12 apostles on them. In verses 19 and 20, you have the foundations adorned with jewels, which in using the number 12 should also make us think of the people of God. This new Jerusalem is in line with what Isaiah predicted would be the case in Isaiah 54. Isaiah 54, verse 11 and verse 12 gives us some interesting imagery here about jewels. Isaiah 54:11 says, "O afflicted one, storm-tossed and not comforted, behold, I will set your stones in antimony and lay your foundations with sapphires. I will make your pinnacles of agate, your gates of carbuncles, and all your wall of precious stones. All your children shall be taught by the Lord, and great shall be the peace of your children." Now, the beginning of Isaiah indicates that Jerusalem has been unfaithful and God's going to judge her. And the end of Isaiah presents this new Jerusalem that's created by God anew, afresh, transformed. And in Isaiah 54, 11 and 12, part of this great image of glory and restoration includes these stones that have bedecked the city. Well, in Revelation 21, friends, we're watching the new Jerusalem. And it doesn't have primarily to do with a place here, but with a people. With a people. So that what the New Jerusalem is pointing to, and what the Old Jerusalem is pointing to, and what the temple was pointing to, and what the priesthood was pointing to, and all of that has to do with God's new creation that's centered around Jesus Christ and the church of Jesus Christ, in whom dwells the Spirit of God. So in Revelation 21, verses 19 and 20, you have these 12 jewels. And I don't want to look at each of them individually, but just to observe that overall, the collection of these jewels, it reminds us of the Old Testament in a very important way, because in Exodus 28, the breastplate of the high priest had 12 gems and jewels. And 8 of them are very clearly identical to the high priest's breastplate, and the other 4 appear to be John's translation equivalents to the rest of those 12. Which means that on the breastplate of the high priest were 12 stones, and here the 12 stones are on the foundation of the city in verses 19 and 20, the foundation of the wall. Now, why did the high priest have stones on his breastplate? The high priest was the only person allowed to go behind the veil before the presence of God on the Day of Atonement in the most holy place. So hold that in view, most holy place and high priesthood. And he had the 12 stones on his breastplate because he wasn't just representing his own sins when he goes before the presence of God on the Day of Atonement, though he certainly represented his own iniquity. He represented the people of God. And he had their stones representing them on his very breastplate. He was symbolizing them coming before the presence of God and in need of atonement. Now, Jesus is our faithful high priest, our great high priest, who surpasses any high priest and from a different order altogether. Not the tribe of Levi, but the line of Melchizedek. And what Hebrews shows us is that Jesus had no sin. And when he goes before the presence of God after making atonement for our sins, he does so once and for all, therefore eliminating the need for temple, sacrifice, and high priest from then on. Because we have Jesus, we have enough. He is sufficient, and he has successfully atoned for our sins. Which means that if the foundation, which has been associated with the church, now has the 12 stones on it, which would previously appear on the high priest who went before the presence of God, I think this is suggesting that the people of God, who are represented here as God's dwelling place and temple, are in the direct presence of God, and we don't need another high priest. Jesus has secured entrance to the throne of grace before a righteous and holy God, because in Christ we are not condemned. In Christ our sin is covered and forgiven, and we can come before God's throne boldly. Hebrews tells us, well, what about in the end when we're raised and made new? So in the book of Exodus, you see these 12 stones on the breastplate of the high priest, and now they're associated with the people of God because we are a kingdom and priests of our God and of Christ. In Revelation 20, verse 6, it tells us this. They'll be priests of God and of Christ. 1 Peter 2 tells us this. This imagery, then, isn't something we should parse out and isolate one jewel from another. Let all 12 of them hang together to make the overall point that we are in the immediate presence of God, which formerly was reserved for only one person, but now in Christ is extended to, granted to, and is secured for all people. We have a priestly character because of our great high priest Christ. In our last verse, let's rejoice together over the wording in verse 21. And the gates were 12 pearls in each of the gates, made of a single pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass. This is beautiful. This isn't the only time a pearl is mentioned in Revelation. Earlier, the unfaithful harlot had them. Revelation 17:4, and in chapter 18, verse 16, the unfaithful harlot had pearls, but that was not fitting with her character. Her character was tainted and deceptive and deceived and sinful and rebellious and blasphemous. The pearls here, though, are fitting with the character of this city, this New Jerusalem. Because the Church of Jesus Christ has been saved to sin no more, and on the day we are raised and glorified, we will rejoice that as heaven comes to earth and as a new creation is our dwelling place forever, we who are in many ways to be understood in this passage as the new Jerusalem will no longer sin. And the depiction of this as these 12 pearls on the 12 gates, and each gate a single pearl, it adorns the people of God with an image of beauty that is fitting with what Christ has secured. Jesus takes us needy and sinful, and he makes us beautiful and glorious by his grace and power. We reflect his power and glory and majesty. This is not a beauty and a glamour that the church has because of its own merit, but the gracious, merciful work of Jesus Christ upon his people. The 12 gates are 12 pearls. The last part of verse 21 says, "And the street of the city was pure gold, transparent as glass." Again, you have this picture of gold and transparency, just like earlier in verse 11, where there was something clear as crystal. And then in verse 18, the city is pure gold, clear as glass. So transparency and gold and brilliance seem to be what's emphasized here. And if the glory of God fills the temple, it is going to be seen and evident, because this is not a material that encases glory, but through which glory will shine. And the Church of Jesus Christ reflects and is a lens for the glory of God, it seems, in this way. In verse 21, the street of the city might refer by contrast to a previous reference to street. In Revelation 11, verse 8, the street of the city is where two bodies of witnesses lay, and they had been killed. The reason Revelation 11 might be in view is because in Revelation 11, verses 1 and 2, the temple was measured. And here in Revelation 21, 17, the angel measures the new temple here. And in Revelation 11, the measuring of the inner temple, or the inner parts of the temple, secures the people of God. That picture of security for the people of God is shown through the various materials on this structure in Revelation 9 and following, or verses 9 and following of Revelation 21. You've got a high wall, you've got these foundations, you've got the great length and width and height, and as the angel is measuring it, this is indeed a secure city. A city that is a temple for God's Spirit. So in verse 21, the street is pure gold, transparent as glass. This is not a street where iniquity was. Early in Revelation 11, the street in Jerusalem was where the two witnesses lay dead because of the murderous ragings of the opposition. And the bodies weren't even dealt with properly. They weren't given a burial. The people mocked and rejoiced. They exchanged presents in this very weird display of glee. Revelation 21:21, though, shows that on this street there is gold, transparent as glass, and this is associated with the people of God. This is not a place where iniquity or transgression happens. This is different. This street and these people are marked by the glory and majesty of God that is reflecting in them. This is a place where God dwells, and we should rejoice that we're part of his people if we're in Christ. Where he dwells, we are secure. Nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. And God is working all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So in Revelation 21:9 and following, this is an image of hope that we should rejoice in, because God is going to bring this glorious church to pass. We have been saved to sin no more, and we will on that day love him anew and see ourselves as products of the glorious work of God, trophies of his grace and mercy on display for all eternity. He has been so kind and so patient toward us. What a privilege it is to be a part of the people of God, for we have no merit on our own, nothing in our hands to bring. It reminds me of the hymn, "The Family of God," where the lines are, "I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God. I've been washed in the fountain, cleansed by his blood, joint heirs with Jesus as we travel this sod. I'm so glad I'm a part of the family of God."